Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is supposedly Sunday, July 23rd, 2006, and this is really is show number 52. Well, I'm not actually here right now. I'm sunning myself on the deck of a sailboat in the Caribbean. I just said that to make you jealous. Did it work? In any event, I really am out of town, but as I promised last week, I have a wonderful stand-in during my absence. One of the NoSilicast fans is a well-known voiceover artist named Ron David, and a few years ago he conducted a fabulous interview with Faye Wells, a 92-year-old pilot from the early days of aviation. I guarantee you'll find this fascinating, even though there are no weird and wacky websites, no shareware tools, and they won't even use the phrase open source once. Let me do a quick introduction of Ron before we get on with the interview. Ron David is a writer, producer, and narrator who is also a commercial pilot, aviation writer, and a public speaker. Mr. David has written and produced programs for the National Air and Space Museum, the Federal Aviation Administration, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, the Airline Pilots Association, and Military and Aerospace Labs. As a narrator, Ron has been heard on Discovery, National Geographic, History, Fox, and the Learning Channel, narrating programs that you've probably seen, like Wings, The Silk Road, Battles That Changed the World, Mysteries of the Deep, America's Most Wanted, and many more. David has a degree in theatrical arts and also has been an aerial display pilot. He sent me some crazy pictures of what he used to do. It's called wing walking. He's married to his former wing walker herself, who is also a White House photographer. They have four children between them, including two Marine combat veterans, one of whom is a Top Gun pilot, and a daughter who manages an art gallery for the city of San Francisco, and another daughter who, like her mother, is a photographer. If you're interested in getting a hold of Ron after you hear this, you can email him at rondavid@gmail.com or visit his website at rondavid.com. I've included a few photos on podfeet.com of Faye, Ron, and his wife, Nar, that I think you'll really enjoy. There's even a picture of Faye with Amelia Earhart. After you hear the audio, head on over and take a look at these wonderful memories. Sit back and enjoy. Next week, I'll bring you the second part of the interview, and I'll be back live on August 6th.
Faye Gillis Wells spent 94 inspiring, action-packed years on this earth, and laughingly says she never applied for a job in her life. Yet her resume can only be read with envy. Faye was an airplane saleswoman, a foreign correspondent, a war correspondent, an explorer, a co-founder of the 99s, the Overseas Press Club, and the International Forest of Friendship, and the first woman broadcast correspondent to cover the White House. She and her husband Linton served America during World War II on assignment for the War Production Board and the OSS in Africa. And, most importantly, she's been an inspiration to young men and women the world over. But she says that she fell into her first job when the airplane she and her instructor were flying came apart in midair and she parachuted to safety, then went right back up in the air again. Aviation pioneer Glenn Curtis was so impressed with Faye that he hired her to become the first woman to demonstrate and sell his famous airplanes. Then she persuaded Curtis to help her and a small core group of women to organize what became the first and most famous women's flying organization, the 99s. This conversation took place in the year 2000, when Faye Gillis Wells was 92 years old. My first question to Faye was whether or not she found it difficult to fly in what most people considered a man's domain.
I liked it the way it was, where you were supposed to be not quite up to the men, but you could outwit them any time you wanted to.
I love that.
I mean, we were in the minority. The women were in the minority, and most of the time the men accepted us because they said, well, you know, if they can't cope with us, we'll always have the upper hand. And so anything you wanted, I used to stand by my plane. We had no starters in those days. And I would stand by my plane looking as though I was polishing it up a little bit, and the boys would come along and say, may we help you? And I'd say, well, would you mind spinning my prop? And then I'd run and jump in the plane and they'd spin my prop. Because we had to do it ourselves because we never knew who we were going to have a forced landing in those days. And first thing you did when you took off was look for a place to land. Just all the way along, you were looking for a place to land just in case. And so then you had to know how to start your plane again after you landed. But the boys seemed to love to help. Well, there were only three girls on the airport when I was getting my license.
Was that a Curtis?
Yeah, Curtis Wright.
Now, you worked for Curtis. You told me something once really amazing. And so I'm going to put the question to you this way. How many times did you apply for a job in the course of your life?
I never applied for a job in my life.
You got to tell me what the reason was. How'd that work?
Well, it just happened. For instance, my job at Curtis, I'd only been flying 3 weeks. I just soloed. And the day after I soloed, my instructor, Sonny, said, well, it's my turn to test the experimental aircraft. And if you want to go up with me, we'll do some aerobatics. And so I said, gee, whoop-a-doo, only 3 weeks flying, I'm going to aerobatics, it's going to be great. And so we took off, and we went all through the maneuvers, and he was coming out of a loop at the top of the loop upside down. Instead of continuing on, he started to fly upside down. And so then all of a sudden, the wings started to flutter, and the plane started to vibrate, and the motor fell out because of the vibration, and then the plane disintegrated, and was thrown out. I didn't even have to undo my safety belt, but just thrown out of the plane. And of course, when we were going to class, well, they said, you know, if anything should happen, it's not going to, but if it happens, you put your hand on the ripcord, and then you step out of the airplane. And then you count to 10 so you're free of everything. And then just before you land, you grab the shroud lines and bend your knees so you don't break a leg when you hit the ground. Well, I was thrown out of the airplane. I didn't have my hand on the ripcord. And I managed to catch it just in time. And then my chute canopied over trees. So I didn't have to try to land. Didn't break a leg. I was just caught in the trees. And I was 60 feet in the air swinging on my parachute, and the fire department came along with the big long ladder and took me out down, and they rushed me back to the airport, put me in a plane, took me right up again, and so they didn't want to lose a paying customer, and they didn't want me to be afraid. You know, it's like you fall off a horse, you have to get back right on. And so I thought, well, this is just what aviation is, you know. Go the rule, and I didn't mind going through the maneuvers again, and I thought they would never happen to me again. And so the next day, when the papers were all full of this stuff about this, there were three people joined the Caterpillar Club the same day, and that was Sonny and myself in Long Island, and Jimmy Doolittle in Chicago. He had to jump. And so Curtis thought, well, gee, if she can do this, we better hire her and send her around to air shows to tell people how safe aviation is. And so I literally fell into my job. I never would have occurred to me to go to Curtis to ask him for a job. I'd only been flying 3 weeks. I mean, so I was just lucky. You know, it just wasn't my time to go because I really didn't know what I was doing. I knew I had to find the ripcord, and I found the ripcord, and I didn't know whether it was right side up or upside down. I didn't know what I was doing, but anyhow, then I had a wonderful time going around all the air shows, meeting all these wonderful people, you know, Jimmy Doolittle. Whoever thought Jimmy Doolittle was going to be 30 seconds over Tokyo? Roscoe Turner and Gilmore the Lion, and, you know, all, because the airports were small in those days, and you met everybody on the airport, you know, and so it was just like a little closed corporation, you know. You knew everybody, you knew Amelia, you knew Blanche, you knew Louise Thaden, and now it's so big, it's a big commercial operation.
I think a lot of the fun's gone out of it.
And we had fun. I mean, we flew by the railroad tracks. You know, we always had a railroad map with us because we didn't have any maps for the airports marked on them or anything. And
always fly the shiny rails.
So we find we flew until we hit a tunnel. Then we didn't know which way to go, whether it goes south around the planet or north. But anyhow, it was great fun. Every time you went up, it was a new experience, you know.
Did you have many dead sticks?
No, never did. Never had a forced landing the whole time I flew. Mm-hmm. And I was just lucky. I mean, I don't know. That was supposed to be, I guess. And one thing led to another, you know.
So when Curtis gave you a job, why, it kind of fulfilled an obligation that you'd made with your dad, didn't it?
What?
Didn't your father say that you either had to get a job or go back
to
school?
Oh, yes, yes.
Can you tell us that story? How did it work with you and Beth and going back to school?
When I was a junior in college, I ran away because we have to pick our majors in your junior year at school. And my sister had taken sociology and psychology as her major and minor. I said, I'm not going to take that. And so I was going to major in English and minor in phys ed. And after a couple months of that, I said, I'm not going to do this. And I'm not going to waste Dad's money. So one day while my sister was in class, I packed a bag and caught the bus down to someplace in Ohio, and took the train into New York, and I stayed with a high school friend of mine who was getting a degree at the Trapagan School of Design. And it was wonderful because in those days they had these apartments for single women who were coming to start careers in New York. And so she was living there, and we had a wonderful time because the dancers, the stage people would come up, and then they'd practice up the night, you know, doing the dances, and we'd dance with them, and it was great fun.
Wasn't the Barbizon Plaza one of those places?
Was I what?
Barbizon Plaza?
Yeah, that was one of them. And, I don't know, and somehow or other I got a job as a banquet cashier for the Commodore Hotel. I have no idea to this day how I got the job, because I never went in and said, hey, you need a cashier, I mean, for banquets. I didn't even know they had them. And I learned all about the hotel business from the inside, and it was wonderful because I was up in the back room of the banquets, and the waiters would always bring me all the pettifores that were left over because they couldn't serve them again. And so then I'd take them down with the girls at night, and we'd sit and eat pettifores and, and talk over what happened that day. And then when Dad found out that I was in this den of iniquity in New York, he said, you can't stay there. You've got to come up to be with me. He was building the smelter at Noranda Goldfields up in northern Quebec. And so I said, well, if that's what Dad wants. So I went up to Noranda in northern Quebec, and being the superintendent's daughter and the only unmarried woman was 600 men, my dance card got filled up pretty fast. And so I had a wonderful time with Dad. I mean, in the wintertime, we went in the sleigh rides, you know, and the big fur blankets over you, and going from one camp to the other. It was...
What was his specialty?
He was a metallurgist, and he helped build the Anaconda Copper Works out in Montana. And when we were living in Canada, he was building the British American Nickel Company. He built the smelter for them. And he went to Noranda and built the gold mine, the smelter for the gold mine. And up in northern Quebec. And he went and worked for the Raritan Copper Works in New Jersey after we came back from Naranda. And he just went from one smelter to another. And then he built the only two electrolytic zinc plants in the Soviet Union.
But he said you had to get a job or go back to school, didn't he?
Yeah, well, that's when I fell in. That's when I took up aviation.
Now, what made you decide that you wanted to take up aviation?
Well, I Emilia had just flown the cert, going across the Atlantic the year before as a sack of potatoes, she said, you know. And it was the year of the first, 29 was the year of the first women's air race. And, of course, there are stories about all these wonderful women, about Blanche and Louise and Bobby Trout and everybody. And so when Dad gave me the ultimatum, I knew I wasn't going back to college. And I said, well, I think aviation is here to stay, so I think I'll take up aviation. And so I went and signed up for aviation. I'd never seen an airplane on the ground. And I didn't know an aileron from a rudder. I didn't know, and I knew nothing about it. But I signed up, and 3 weeks later, I was in the newspapers. I mean, it had nothing to do with it. It just happened.
All you had to do was survive, and you became a hero.
Right, right. Begin again, you know. And then we went to Russia because Dad was over there, and it was a depression. And the Soviet Union, Stalin had just started the first five-year plan. And he realized that his agrarian country would not survive in the economic world. And so he hired 1,000 American engineers, experts, business people to come over to the Soviet Union to help him build the country. And so Dad was picked to build electrolytic zinc plants in the Soviet Union.
And that's how you wound up over there.
That's why I wound up over there.
We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. I wanted to go back and talk again about... I wanted to ask you to tell me a little bit about the Caterpillar Club. Can you tell me what it is?
About the what?
Caterpillar Club.
Oh, the Caterpillar Club is called the Caterpillar Club because in those days the parachutes were all made of pure silk. And when a caterpillar gets in trouble, it lets itself down with a strand of silk. That's why we were called caterpillars.
Because the caterpillar also made the silk? Was it the caterpillar?
Yeah, it was real silk.
Caterpillar made the silk.
Yeah.
Let itself down by the strand.
Yeah.
And that same silk was made into the parachute.
Mm-hmm.
And the parachute, so when a person's life was saved by parachute.
Right, right. That's when you're a caterpillar. First woman pilot member of the Caterpillar Club.
You were the first woman. That's kind of notorious.
There was another girl who jumped earlier, but she jumped and the chute didn't open, so her auxiliary chute she had to use. But she jumped deliberately, so she didn't count.
Right.
But Irving Chute used her because they wanted the publicity to let people know that women can also use the parachute. But she's not a caterpillar.
Yeah. And Jimmy Doolittle got it the same day. You don't remember what happened to him that day, do you?
President Bush did, too. World War II.
That's right.
President Bush is a caterpillar.
That's right. Oh, there must be a whole bunch of members now.
Yeah.
But
I number 160.
That's your number? And you still have your certificate.
Right here.
Yeah, I think I saw it the other day. We'll take a picture of it again before
it's we right leave. Over there.
Right. What was it like flying in those days? Did you enjoy those? You were flying the Curtis fledgling. That's a really nifty little airplane.
Oh, it's wonderful. I was trying to find the story about it. Somebody just sent me the Long Island Museum of Aviation has a story about the Curtis fledgling. And they told all about how this ugly little thing is so safe, and it was safe. Great big, you know, biplane. So if you had to crash or something, it came in on a wing. By the time the wing had crumbled to the body, it would, all the force would be gone. You were safe anyhow. So, I mean, you just felt very safe in it. And they mentioned, they said, there weren't too many of the Curtiss fledglings made, but they gave them a list. And on this list, they have NC-8664, and that was my plane. When they put the 225 motor in it instead of the one, it was built for a 165, and when they upped the power to see if it would take the stress, why, they had to put an experimental aircraft. So they took the NC off and put X on it. And so that they mentioned that they had that airplane, 8664.
Did you have a feeling of exhilaration when you flew, when you got up there by yourself? I used to giggle sometimes.
Well, I thought it was wonderful. You went looking around, you know, because you're going to see somebody, you'd buzz the house and let them know you come out to the airport to pick you up, and I thought it was fun. I loved it. You go up, because you were boss, you know. You got up, you have to get down. So you felt very smart when you made it. And of course, we had no brakes, and so we had to fishtail down the runway to slow us down. Not only to slow us down, but because the motor was up so high and you were sitting way back here, you couldn't see over the motor, so you had to fishtail to see if what was on the runway ahead of you, if anything. And so, and then if you were going too fast, then you had learned how to ground loop, so when you got the end of the runway, you could come back without running off the runway. And you had all those little things, you know, to do. You had to tie the throttle when you were going to spin your prop yourself, and then run back around, jump in for it before the plane got roaring too much, and take it off.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Please try and pace yourself now, because the second half of this interview is up already, but try not to listen to it for a week, or you're going to run out of stuff till I get back. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.